Even as she watched, they saw the strongest of the alliances fall apart in a fiery betrayal as one flank fell upon the other. Bay snorted in disgust.
"Faithless fanatics," she muttered.
There was a chitter from the shelf to her left. A row of small pink eyes looked down upon her.
"Which of you said that?"
She glared at the little tarsier-like wazoon, each staring out the entrance hatch of its own little spy globe. The eyes blinked back at her. The wazoon snickered in amusement, but none of them answered her directly. Bayes sniffed.
"Well, you're right, of course. The fanatics have quick reactions on their side. They do not stop and consider, but dive right in, while we moderates must ponder before we act."
Especially the ever-cautious Cynthians, she thought. Earthlings are supposed to be our allies, yet timidly we talk and consider, we protest to the impotent institutes, and send expendable scouts to spy upon the battle. The bazoon chattered a warning.
"I know," she snapped. "Don't you think I know my business? So there's a watcher probe up ahead. One of you go take care of it and don't bother me. Can't you see I'm busy?"
The eyes blinked at her. One pair vanished as the wazoon scuttled into its tiny ship and closed the hatch. In a moment, a small shudder passed through the scout as the probe departed. "Luck to you, small wazoon, fateful client," she thought. Feigning nonchalance, she watched as the tiny probe danced ahead amongst the planetoid debris, sneaking toward the watcher probe that lay in Bay's path. "One expendable scout," she thought bitterly. "The Timbrimi are fighting for their lives. Earth is besieged, half her colonies taken, and still we Cynthians wait and watch, watch and wait, sending only me and my team to observe." A small flame burned suddenly, casting stark shadows through the asteroid field. The wazoon let out a low groan of mourning, stopping quickly when Bay looked their way.
"Do not hide your feelings from me, my brave wazoon," she murmured. "You are clients and brave warriors, not slaves. Mourn your colleague who died so well for us."
She thought about her own cool, careful people, amongst whom she always felt a stranger.
"Feel,"
she insisted, surprised by her own vehemence.
"There is no shame in caring, my little wazoon. In this you may be greater than your patron race, when you are grown up and on your own."
Bay piloted closer to the water world, where the battle raged, feeling more akin to her little client comrades than to her own ever-cautious race. Chapter 25 Thomas Orley. Orley looked upon his treasure, a thing he had sought for 12 years. It appeared to be intact, the first of its kind ever to fall into human hands. Only twice had micro-branch libraries designed for other races been captured by human crews from ships defeated in skirmishes over the last 200 years. In each case, the repositories were damaged. Attempts to study them were informative, but one mistake or another always caused the semi-intelligent machines to self-destruct. This was the first ever recovered from a warship of a powerful galactic patron race, and the first taken since certain Timbrimi had joined in this clandestine research. The unit was a beige box, about 3 meters by 2 by 1, with simple optical access ports. Halfway along one side was the rayed spiral symbol of the library. It was lashed to a cargo sled along with other booty, including 3 probability coils, undamaged and irreplaceable. Anna Suessi would ride back to Streaker, protecting those as a mother hen her eggs. Only when he saw them safely in Emerson Dionetti's hands would he turn around to come back here. Tom wrote routing instructions on a wax board. With any luck, the crew back at Streaker would turn the micro-branch unit over to Krydike or Jillian without undue attention. He adhered the shipping slip so that it covered the library glyph. Not that his interest in a captured micro-branch was particularly secret. The crew here had helped him pry it from the Thenanin ship. But the fewer who knew the details, the better, especially if they should ever be captured. If his instructions were followed, the unit would be plugged into the comm in his own cabin, to outward appearances a normal communication screen. He imagined the Nis would be impressed. Tom wished he could be there when the Timbrimi machine found out what it suddenly had access to. The smug thing would probably be speechless for half a day. He hoped it wouldn't be too stunned. He wanted something from it right away. Suessi was already asleep, tethered to his precious salvage. Tom made sure the instructions were well secured. Then he swam up toward the sheer outcrop of rock overlooking the wrecked alien starship. Neo-Fen swarmed over the hulk, making detailed measurements from without and within. At word from Krydike, charges would be set off, beginning a process that would leave the giant battleship's core a reamed and empty cavity. By now the scout they had sent back should have reached Streaker with its initial report, and the sled should already be returning down the new shortcut they had found. Bringing a monofilament intercom line from home, it ought to meet the salvage sled about halfway. All this assumed home was still there. Tom guessed the battle still raged above Kithrop. Space war was a slow thing, especially as practiced by the long-viewed galactics. They might still be at it in a year or two, though he doubted it. That much time would allow reinforcements to arrive and produce a war of attrition. It was unlikely the fanatic alliances would let things come to that pass. In any event, Streaker's crew had to act as if the war were about to end any day now. So long as confusion reigned above, they still had a chance. Tom went over his plan again, and came to the same conclusion. He had no other choice. There were three conceivable ways they might escape the trap they were in. Rescue, negotiation, and trickery. Rescue was a nice image, but Earth herself didn't have the strength to come and deliver them. Together with her allies, she could barely match one of the pseudo-religious factions in the battle over Kithrop. The Galactic Institutes might intervene. What law there was demanded that Streaker report directly to them. Problem was, the Institutes had little power of their own, like the feeble versions of world government Earth had almost died of in the 20th century. They relied on mass opinion and volunteer levies. The majority moderates might finally decide that Streaker's discovery should be shared by all, but Tom figured it would take years for the necessary alliances to form. Negotiation seemed as faint a hope as rescue. In any event, Krydike had Jillian and Hikaki and Metz to help him if it ever came to haggling with a victor in the space battle. They didn't need Tom for that. That left clever schemes and subtle deceptions, finding a way to thwart the enemy when rescue and negotiation fail. That's my job. The ocean was deeper and darker here than 50 kilometers to the east, where strings of metal mounds grew in hilly shallows along the edges of a thin crustal plate. In the area where Hikahi's party had been rescued, the water was metal-enriched by a chain of semi-active volcanoes. There were no true metal mounds in this area, and the long-dead volcanic islands were worn down to the water's surface. When he looked away from the crumpled Thenanin wreck and the trail of havoc it had left before coming to rest, Tom found the scenery restful, its beauty calming. Drifting dark yellow fronds of danglevine, waving like corn silk from the surface, reminded him of the color of Jillian's hair. Orly hummed to himself, a melody few other human beings could attempt. Small gene-crafted sinuses reverberated under his skull, sending a low refrain into the water around him. In sleep, your caring touches me, where, waking, I let it not. In distance, I will call to you and touch you as you sleep. Of course, Jillian couldn't actually hear his gift poem. His own psi powers were quite modest. Still, she might pick up a hint. Other things she had done had surprised him more. The dolphin escort gathered at the sled. Suessi had awakened and was checking the lashings with Lieutenant Tisht. Tom launched himself from his aerie toward the group. Tisht saw him and took a quick breath from an air dome before swimming up to meet him halfway.
"I wish you would reconsider doing this," she implored when they met. "I'll be frank. Your presence is good for morale. If you were lost, it would be a blow."
Tom smiled and put a hand on her flank. He had already come to terms with his poor chances of returning. "I don't see any other way, Tisht. All the other parts of my plan can be handled by others, but I'm the only one who can bait the hook. You know that." "Besides," he grinned, "Krydike will have one more chance to call me back if he doesn't like the plan. I asked that he send Jillian to meet me at Hikahi's Island with the glider and the supplies I need. If she tells me his answer is no, I'll be back at the ship before you." Tisht looked away.
"I doubt he'll say no,"
she whistled low and almost inaudibly.
"Hmm. What do you mean?"
Evasively, Tisht answered in trinary.
"Krydike leads us, is our master, yet we imagine secret orders."
Tom sighed. There it was again, the suspicion that Earth would never let the first dolphin-commanded vessel go out without disguised human supervision. Naturally, most of the rumors centered around himself. It was bothersome, because Krydike was an excellent captain. Also, it detracted from one of the purposes of the mission, to make a demonstration that would boost Neo-Finn self-confidence for a generation.
"Then, in my leaving, learn a lesson. A bored streaker is your captain."
Tisht must have been running low on the breath she had taken at the sled's air dome. Bubbles leaked from her blowmouth. Still, she looked back at him resignedly and spoke in Anglic.
"All right. After Suessi leaves, we'll get you on your way. We'll continue working here until we get orders from Krydike."
"Good," Tom nodded. "And you still approve of the rest of the plan?" Tisht turned away, her eyes recessed.
"Kanik and Logic join to sing its tune. The plan is all between us and our doom. We'll all do our part."
Tom reached over and hugged her. "I know we can count on you, you sweet old fish catcher. I'm not worried at all. Now, let's say goodbye to Hannah so I can be on my way. I don't want Jill to get to the island before me." He dove toward the sled, but Tisht remained behind for a moment. Although the air in her lungs was growing stale, she lay still, watching him swim away. Her sonar click swept over him as he descended. She caressed him with her hearing and sang a quiet requiem.
"They cast their nets to catch us, those of Iki, yet you are there to cut the nets. Good walker, always, you cut the nets, though they'll take in payment your life."
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 4,